Coast to coast and worldwide on the internet. This is Coast to Coast AM with George Norrie.
Dr. Ken Hansen, he's a dynamic author, and we'll be back with him in a moment because he has investigated some ancient texts, and we'll talk with him about that in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. Dr. Ken Hansen is an author, lecturer, founder of Treasures in Time, an organization devoted to disseminating knowledge of the biblical and classical world. He has dug on archaeological sites in the Middle East, lived in a politically volatile region of northern Galilee, and taught Hebrew on an Israeli agricultural settlement. He also worked with a television news gathering operation in a war zone in southern Lebanon at the height of the civil war that left the jewel of the Mediterranean in ruins. Having been up close and personal with the face of terrorism, Dr. Hansen lends a timeless perspective to the challenges of the future. He currently serves at the University of Central Florida in Orlando, where he teaches courses on Jewish history from ancient times through the 20th century, including the rise of Israel and the Holocaust. He is our guest tonight on Coast to Coast. Ken, how are you? Good to have you back.
Good to be back, George, and warm shalom from the heart of Central Florida.
I have to ask you about this uproar in the Catholic Church with the Da Vinci Code. First of all, a higher up in the Vatican has told people not to read the book, not to buy it. And then another archbishop in South America said, no, this bishop was talking on his own. He wasn't sanctioned by the church. Are you up to speed on any of that, Ken? What's going on there?
Well, it's kind of paradoxical, to say the least, because in the first place, we're dealing with fiction, and everybody knows that this is a fictional piece. It's a novel, but it's based upon a lot of investigation that's been done over years. It's based on some other material. One book is called Holy Blood, Holy Grail, and that is really the kernel of research from which the Da Vinci Code sprung. Now, the trouble that the Vatican obviously has with a book like this, with a novel like this, is the fact that it does fly in the face of traditional Catholic teaching about Jesus being forever celibate. He was married to the church, mm-hmm. in the eyes of the church. So one can imagine how threatening, how incendiary the very ideas presented in this novel and in the earlier book would be. The idea that Jesus consorted with Mary Magdalene and produced a child by her. The paradox is that the book, that is the novel, is both not so trustworthy and somewhat trustworthy at the same time.
Well, it's like fiction, nonfiction at the same time, right?
It's fiction, nonfiction. But specifically, the closer one comes to the present time in this novel, the things that are related about Opus Dei, for example, this secretive Catholic organization, the closer one approaches to the present time in this novel, the less trustworthy it becomes. Opus Dei really is not what the novel makes it out to be. However, the farther back you go in time, into antiquity, the more plausible some of these ideas and some of these theories become, especially, for example, with Mary Magdalene, when we have an ancient text,
mm-hmm.
which declares, and I'm quoting it, "And the companion, Mary Magdalene, he loved her more than all the disciples, and used to kiss her often on her mouth." My goodness.
My goodness, indeed.
Here is an apocryphal text that most people don't even know existed. It's been around for a long time, and yet there it is in black and white. What do you do with a text like that? It's not something you find in traditional Gospels, but it's there nonetheless. So this is not just hanging on thin air, especially when you go far back into antiquity.
Now, this text, I mean, do people who are scholars like you, do they know about this?
Sure, but don't quite know what to do with it. And the beauty of being a scholar is that you really don't have to spin theology. That's why I'm not a theologian, right? You just look at the facts that are at hand, and you say, here they are. This is what we have. It's up to individuals to interpret them. Do you take this text at its face value, or do you decide, I really don't trust it, essentially? Nobody can say that. This is an individual, this is a personal decision. But we can highlight the texts themselves, tell people where they come from, give a little bit of a sense about them, so that hopefully people can come to their own conclusions.
Ken, how do we know that all these ancient texts in the Bible and everything that we have read from the ancients wasn't just a made-up story by some great authors of the time?
Yeah, well, oddly enough, a lot of scholars assume just that, not just about these extraneous texts that never quite made it into the Bible, but about the Bible itself. This is very heated debate in the halls of academe. How much of the Bible can be trusted in terms of even the authorship? Did Moses, for example, really write the books of Moses? Did somebody else write them and just describe them to Moses? And that's only the tip of the iceberg. How many Isaiahs are there? One, two, three, more? It goes on and on. It's endless. So if you're going to examine the books of the traditional Bible in that way, well, hey, here's extraneous books we ought to throw into the mix as well. Why not?
Absolutely. What do you think happened 2,000 years ago on this planet, in that area that, of course, is so controversial today?
Well, I like to tell my students the more things change, the more they stay the same. People had metaphysical experience, just as people have metaphysical experiences today. Human beings are human beings, and however far back into the past we go, we find that people have a sense that there is something more than just flesh and blood, something more than just this material realm. The greatest mystery in the universe is the universe itself. Why do we exist? Or as Stephen Hawking puts it, why did the universe go to all the trouble of existing? And
yeah,
as
right.
far back as you go, people have struggled with this and have had metaphysical experience. Many have claimed to have had out-of-body experience. Some of these experiences sound like extraterrestrial encounters. The kind of things that people report today are exactly what the ancients reported. That's the amazing thing. So that when we look at people's experience today, before we just cavalierly dismiss them, we ought to consider what the ancients wrote about, what they related. And there are many amazing such encounters that are related, not only in the Bible, people think it just stops with the Bible itself, but in these extra books, 2,000 years ago, 2,500 years ago, 3,000 years ago.
Let's talk a little bit, Ken, about some of the work you've done into these lost texts. How were they found?
Well, they've always been around. Some of them have been found only in the 20th century, but the bulk of them have been around. It's just that most people never knew they existed, myself included. I went over to the Middle East as a young undergraduate student, a history student, determined just to explore and find out what I can about the roots of Western thought and culture. I ended up digging into the Dead Sea Scrolls, an amazing cache of ancient parchments discovered in the middle of the 20th century, determined to find out what the reality is behind the Dead Sea Scrolls. And sure enough, I encountered these extraneous books, books that never made it into the Bible. We have fragments of these books that feature prominently among the Dead Sea Scrolls, 2,000 years old. Now, these books, most of them were originally composed in Hebrew and Aramaic between 2,000 and 3,000 years ago, but the originals were in most cases lost, and that's why I call this stuff the Lost Bible. The originals were lost. They were not recopied. They were deliberately suppressed in most instances by self-righteous clerics and sages and religious leaders, and were only copied by a few monks here and there in other languages, such as Greek or Coptic. So really, we're dealing with a whole treasure trove of these lost books that I discovered, could not help but discover. I like to say I didn't find them, they found me, and just took hold of me, and I began to dig into them. Again, they've been around. Most of them have been known for the last two millennia, but only by scholars, only by a few clerics here and there. The rank and file have never even heard of these books. And some of them, as I mentioned, were discovered only in the middle of the 20th century. One entire cache found in a town in Egypt called Nag Hammadi, found by an Egyptian farmer, turned out to be one of the most important archaeological finds in all of history.
Now, were the contents known as well, beyond just finding the texts?
Well, with the books that we knew about, yes, the contents were known. For example, I'll give you an example, the Book of Jubilees. This was known to have existed all along, but we never had an original. We only had copies of copies, and those translated from Hebrew, Aramaic into Greek, other languages, Coptic, and so on. So, to all intents and purposes, people could not relate to these books, even though we knew they existed. But the cache found in Egypt at Nag Hammadi, these were entire books we never knew existed before.
What were they written on, Ken?
They were written on papyrus, on codices, as they're called, stuffed into pottery jars. When this farmer named Muhammad Ali, can you imagine?
Really? Yeah, that's right.
In 1945, out in his field, stumbled upon these pottery jars, and inside were 13 codices of wadded up papyri, essentially, containing entire books, gospels, especially gospels that we never knew existed before.
What are the possibilities that there are other texts out there somewhere in other farmers' fields, who knows where, in caves, they haven't been discovered, that could just shake the foundation of everything we understand?
Well, scholars are notorious skeptics, myself included, and we like to think, well, we've found just about everything
that can be found yeah.
Until all of a sudden, out of the clear blue, somebody finds something else. So I have to hedge on this and say it is entirely possible. In fact, just a few years ago, the State of Israel mounted an archaeological expedition on the shores of the Dead Sea to find out if any more Dead Sea Scrolls, in fact, might be out there hidden away in these caves. And there's another parallel cache of material, not unlike what was found in Egypt in the middle of the 20th century, found along the shores of the Dead Sea, a whole library of ancient parchments. Israel mounted an expedition, an Indiana Jones type of expedition, to see if they could find more. It didn't turn up anything. That does not mean that there is not more out there. I think it's entirely possible.
If there are more, what's left of the story that hasn't been revealed? I mean, what more could someone have written about? Maybe it would just be corroborating stories, for example. They might say the same thing, but in a different way, a different style. Or would it be so different, so far-fetched, that it would just make you go, my gosh?
Sometimes these stories are, in fact, my gosh kind of stories. They really are. Mind-blowing, and especially on the metaphysical end of it, relating journeys into heaven, for example, out-of-body experience. Some people would make them akin to alien encounters, seriously.
Right.
It's just that phenomenal. One text from the Dead Sea Scrolls describes an ascent up into the heavenly temple accompanied by angelic songs, mirroring the worship going on down here on the earth. It's only a copy, a mirror image of a heavenly worship in this divine realm, and the witness is literally taken up above the earth into that celestial temple accompanied by angels. I mean, who would imagine such a thing would be found? Now, there are rumors, in fact, of yet another similar type of text having to do with an angelic encounter, mm-hmm. being taken up through a series of seven heavens. There are rumors of such a text existing. They have not yet been corroborated.
If they exist, where might they be?
There was rumor, for example, that this text made its way to a monastery, I believe, in the heart of Europe, and then yet it was never produced.
Ah.
So we don't know at this point. But there are enough rumors out there to think that it might not be just so much fancy. There really might be something to this, and to other rumors as well.
Well, I've always wondered too, Ken, that some people who are so wealthy that will spend $40, $50, $60 million on artwork, if they knew these existed, they would pay that kind of money just to keep it, just to have it, just to say to themselves,
sure,
my gosh, look what I have.
Absolutely.
And I think that's possible.
Sure. Sure. I mean, these have potentially such astounding impact for the Christian world, also for the Jewish world, especially in the realm of mysticism, so-called Kabbalah, of which there is quite a bit in this lost Bible.
If all these stories we've heard of godlike figures and issues like that turned out to be interpreting an extraterrestrial visitation or ongoing extraterrestrial visitations, would that shake the foundation of religion, or would it add to it? Maybe they just merely misinterpreted what they saw. Maybe they weren't angels. Maybe they were aliens. Maybe it wasn't, as you say, a temple in the sky. It was a UFO, a craft of some sort.
Well, that's the beauty of being a scholar. Again, you don't have to come to such conclusions. What we can say is, here is the text. Here is what it says. You can interpret it as you will. And sure enough, some of these do lend themselves to precisely that kind of interpretation. People are generally familiar with the book of Ezekiel,
yes,
which is in traditional Bibles, and this incredible experience that sounds like an alien encounter. But we have others. We have a story of Abraham, for example, who we're told in this non-biblical text called the Testament of Abraham, we're told that he is lifted up through means of some kind of angelic visitation, but he's lifted up above the surface of the earth and taken across it so that he can look down and see things that are going on the earth underneath him. What is this? Is this an ancient person describing in the best way he can what we would call a close encounter with an alien presence? As scholars, we can't weigh in on that. We can just say, here's the text. Hey, it lends itself to multiple interpretations.
Does Dr. Ken Hansen have a personal view on what this might be?
Oh, dear. If I did, I would probably be reluctant to say.
I can't squeeze it out of you this time. Right?
Maybe. We'll
see.
I'll meditate on that,
okay,
for a little while.
Because I have a feeling you have a view on this. I'm not wrong
that
about that.
You right.
Yeah, okay. The as we get close to Easter and the story of the resurrection, It has always, always fascinated me, Ken, since I was a boy growing up, because I kept trying to say, how could this happen? How could something like this occur? And they move a rock out of the way, and there's no body, it's gone. And then if the Shroud of Turin is indeed authentic, and it might be, what a great, tremendous story. What happened during this period? I would love to have lived then. I bet you would too.
Oh, my. As a matter of fact, well, that period of time is called the Second Temple period in Judaism, in the Jewish world. And to my way of thinking, it's the most fascinating, incredible period of history ever to have transpired, because it does indeed lay the groundwork for the whole modern world, the Western world as we know it, for the three dominant monotheistic faiths of the Western world, Judaism, Christianity, and Islam, all came directly out of this cauldron of incredible creative spiritual activity. And once again, bragging on scholarship, since we don't have to form religious conclusions per se, we can simply trot this stuff out and sit down at a common table from varying religious backgrounds and say, these are the texts, here's what we have, without trying to hit each over the head saying, my religion is better than yours.
Yeah, exactly.
We're all trying to simply understand the text that we have and maybe solve maybe one more little part of this mystery.
When we come back, let's talk about miracles, Ken, and just get your take on what you think they might have been.
Get it in writing with the After Dark newsletter. Subscribe by calling 1-888-727-5505. From the City of Angels, this is Coast to Coast AM with George Norrie.
Boy, the editor of the After Dark newsletter called me today, News Magazine, and said, George, this issue that is coming out, you are going to love it. Beyond just talking about did we really land on the moon, I mean, that's coming up, but with really some neat facts in the After Dark newsletter. They talk about some other things, too, about an upcoming UFO special issue for the summer. You're going to love it. How do you subscribe to the After Dark newsletter and get 14 issues for the price of 12? That's simple. Call 1-888-727-5505. That's 1-888-727-5505. You can also go online at coasttocoastam.com. And welcome back to Coast with Dr. Ken Hansen. Ken, miracles, they've occurred since the beginning of time. What do you think they are? Why do you think they occur? I mean, are they controlled by people who have certain mystical powers, or do they just happen by chance?
My, have you asked a loaded question, George? How many hours do we have for this?
Yeah, really? Lots.
Oh, my goodness. So how do we begin to talk about miracles? Okay, I'm a believer in miracles, even though I'm an academician and try to pull my punches as much as possible and not tell people what to believe, but nonetheless, absolutely. And the amazing thing is that you find stories of miracles in all of the great religious traditions. You look back into this amazing historical period we've been talking about, the Second Temple period, and there are miracles galore. Not only do we find miracles in the New Testament, but there are stories of ancient Jewish sages, rabbis, who went around with healing powers. Was really incredible. This could not have come about just by someone making wild reports, unsubstantiated. As I said before, human beings are who they are across time, and just as people report miraculous healings, recoveries, and so on in our own time, so did they in antiquity. So these texts are extremely valuable on that level. And let me also point out something that Jesus of Nazareth said vis-a-vis his main message, the kingdom of heaven. Huge mistake people make when they think about the kingdom of heaven. Ask anybody and they'll tell you this is the future, this is the end of the world, when the kingdom of heaven comes. Well, frankly, this is a rabbinic term that we find in Judaism. We find this in the Talmud. We find that this kingdom is a Jewish expression for a present tense fullness of life on a metaphysical level. To be whole, to be well, whatever your problem is, whatever bugs you, to be whole and well right here and now, not the hereafter, but the here and now. The kingdom of heaven is present tense. And that's why, in the standpoint of Jesus of Nazareth, the miracles he performed are not something you can just put on the side, as some scholars in history have done, like Albert Schweitzer, who tried to rewrite the story of Jesus with no miracles. In the end, you have no historical Jesus, because those miracles are essential to discovering the historical person. But the same is true with other sages, rabbis, as I mentioned, in ancient times, miracle stories galore. There's another level of miracles, however, where I have to hesitate. And let me just stress that metaphysics is by nature non-literal. And people can get themselves into a whole lot of trouble, back themselves into a corner, when they try to look at figurative language in an overly literal way. And that is, frankly, what I think we're looking at when it comes to some
of the
miracle stories, especially some of the more violent ones. And people are really, really bothered when they read the Bible and they find stories about little ones being dashed against the rocks and all in the name of God. This sounds like a jihad. This is problematical. But at that point, you have to step back from the text. And you have to ask, now wait a second, beyond anything happening literally, what's the message? What is the attempt here to convey to us? And that is where I get really excited. Because the message of the biblical text, both the traditional Bible and this lost Bible that I've written about, is that the universe that we inhabit is not random. It's not by chance. It's going somewhere. And in our own day and age, this is what it comes down to. Either you believe that this is all just a big machine that came about.
That just happened.
That just happened. Either you believe that that's all there is, a big bang, perhaps to be followed by a big crunch, or you don't accept that. You think that there is something more. You think that there is a design, that there is a beginning, and that there is an end, and that history is directional, and furthermore, the divine presence intervenes in it. That's the message of the miracles, even the violent ones. I don't look for literal reality behind some of these stories. I look for that message saying that the divine presence is intervening in human history. This is not an accident. There is a design behind everything we look at around us. It's called the anthropic principle in astrophysics, by the way. The universe could not have come about by accident.
No, I believe entirely that there was some kind of creation behind it. I don't exactly understand it, and I'm sure a lot of people can, even scholars, don't understand it. But as you say, it just didn't happen by chance. There's just too much order out there, and you can see in various star clusters and things. I mean, it's almost
Absolutely.
As if they're all alive. And,
yeah.
You know, and that they've got a mission. They know what to do. It's strange.
Well, the universe seems to have been designed deliberately to bring forth life and intelligent life. And the chances, just looking at it from the standpoint of science and astrophysics, the chances that the order we see would have come about by itself are infinitesimally small, minute. After the Big Bang, honestly, we should have had just a gaseous, nebulous fog, nothing like the order that we see.
You know, Ken, the things you talk about, which really strike nerves on so many people, because I think that's one of the driving forces beyond people who, you know, go home and they have dinner with their families and they have to wake up in the morning and they go to work or they work the night shift. You know, life is tough and you got to make it work. But I think through it all, there's an element now that seems to be growing in people about this thought of who am I, what am I, and what am I doing here? And I think as we get older, we begin to think about that a little bit more for obvious reasons. You know, when
sure.
we check out, we want to make sure there's a reason we're checking out. But
yeah.
but I feel it is happening more than maybe even a few years ago, and I don't know why. How about you?
Well, yeah, I think ever since the turn of the millennium especially, we have seen people focusing back and very much inward again, looking inside, looking to an inner truth, an inner reality. If you dig into this lost Bible, you'll find a golden thread, as I like to call it, that holds this material together, no matter which book you're looking at. And they're all disparate books written in different places and different times. They didn't make it into the Bible, as I mentioned, but the thing that holds them all together is the idea that we as human beings are more than what we know. We are the very stuff of deity. And that is an idea that, call it New Age, but it's very much surfaced since the turn of the millennium, underscored by the events of 9/11, and who cannot look inside and ask, who am I, what am I? I look back at the creation account in the Hebrew Bible, being a Hebrew scholar, and we're told that this creature was formed, Adam. Actually, the Hebrew word is Adam.
Mm-hmm.
Now, who is this? Is this a male? Is this a man? I suppose.
Was he a space traveler? You know,
a space traveler, right? Is this some kind of bedtime story? How literally do we take it? When you look at the very word Adam, metaphysically, you tear it apart from its Hebrew root. You find that it's related to the word Adama, which means ground or earth, and it's related to another word, Adom, which means red, as in the red earth. And on one level, it seems to be emphasizing that all we are is dust. But you look at the same word metaphysically on a different level, and this is where the Lost Bible seems to take it. You look at that same word, and you find the root dam, blood, hidden in that word Adam. And then you find the prefix, the Hebrew letter Aleph, in front of the dam, and the Aleph can be short for the word Elohim, or God, God's blood. We are the very stuff of deity, and there's an innate sense of this, I think, in every human being, even those who try to deny it and try to cover it up. But those are the two options that you have when you look at the Bible. How are you going to look at human beings? Are you going to look at us as just so much dust in this abject misery, maybe looking for pie in the sky when we die? Or are you going to really see yourself as divine, in a sense? And that's, again, where the lost Bible tends to take you. Over and over, we have statements about the inherent divinity of the individual.
You know, when you look at all of these things and you try to interpret what they may be, and as you look at the Genesis, which is the beginning of the Bible, what goes through your mind, Ken, when you read about the fallen angels? You know, they came down to breed with daughters of man. I mean, you look at that and you're going, how could somebody make that up?
Yeah.
And then what do they mean if it's true? So as a scholar, what did they mean?
Yeah, interesting you should ask that. I noticed that one of the guests last night was talking about that very passage in the book of Genesis. You look at the passage itself, and it mentions this group of beings, whoever they are, called the Nephilim.
Mm-hmm.
It's only one verse. That's it. One verse in the Hebrew text that there were Nephilim in those days. You find one other brief verse in the book of Numbers about the Nephilim, and it invites speculation. I think these two tiny passages have invited more speculation than any in world literature, and yet you look at them and you say, what's there to go on here? Like, where's the beef?
Right,
you know?
Right. Yet it's there.
It's there. Included. And you have to think there's got to be something more, and sure enough, you look at these apocryphal books, the ones that didn't make it. The book of First Enoch, for example, has all manner of additional information that the Bible doesn't tell you. And there must have been a whole fund of knowledge, a whole folklore related to an angelic host. The book of Enoch calls them the Watchers. And if we read that ancient text, it says that while the sons of men multiplied, fair and lovely daughters were born to them, and the Watchers, these are some angelic hosts, they're not mentioned in the Bible per se, those sons of heaven, it tells us, were attracted to them, lusted after them, and they said to one another, let's seek out the daughters of men and rear sons for ourselves. It says there were 200 of them altogether.
I mean, yeah, they were that specific in even numbers. They counted them.
Yeah, they counted them. They descended on the summit of Mount Hermon, that's in northern Galilee, during the days of Enoch's father, Yared. And then the text goes on. Elsewhere it says, the women became pregnant by the Watchers and gave birth to the giants, who grew up to be 3,000 cubits tall. They were born according to the laws of nature, and grew up at a constant rate. None were able to provide for their rapacious appetites. Therefore, the Nephilim, the giants, conspired to kill the men and eat them. They conspired, in other words, to devour humankind from off the face of the earth. And the text goes on and tells us that whereas in traditional Bibles the idea is that it was simply sin that caused the waters of the flood to be sent in the days of Noah, the lost Bible tells us it was the Nephilim. It was this race of hybrids, as it were, who might have destroyed humanity had it not been for the destruction of the floodwaters. That was the real reason that the flood came.
To get rid of them, not us.
To get rid of it. Yeah, exactly. Exactly. I mean, this is a whole wealth of tradition that most people never even knew existed, nor could they find it in traditional Bibles.
I did not know about the passage that they were eating human beings.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So what I've done in my own book called Secrets from the Lost Bible is I've gone back to these original apocryphal books that never made it, and I've retranslated them into more of a flowing English, even a semi-paraphrase, so that modern people can pick this up and say, "Wow, you know, I didn't know this existed before," and really cuddle up with this material. Now. Of course, again, as a scholar, I have to hedge a little bit, and I cannot tell you what the text means. I can just tell you what it says. Now, what people do with that is a matter of interpretation, you know, and you can take that any way you want. You can do as Zachariah Sitchin, and you can posit that, in fact, this was a whole race of aliens who came and impregnated human women.
True.
And there have, as we know, been tales of UFO abductions alleging that men and women are taken into spacecraft,
mm-hmm.
Sexually used. I noticed, again, one of your guests last night talked about some kind of sexual assault by a being. And who is this being? Who can say?
Mm-hmm.
Right? But it is more than tantalizing to find ancient depictions of similar stories. As a scholar, I can't go there, as it were. But I can say, here's the text.
But you can also say something happened.
Something happened. Now you can take that literally. You can also take it on an allegorical level. And that's something I want to challenge people to do. Whatever you do with the idea of, say, an alien visitation, if you want to go there, fine. But don't miss the allegorical level in this, that if you understand even human beings as angelic, in a sense, what's really the problem that's related here is desire, lust, wanting something additional than what's inside of us. When we mix divine with flesh, we end up producing monsters, and we can make ourselves into monsters, following our own rapacious appetites, as it were, as opposed to keeping ourselves thinking the right way, meditating on the right things, on the kind of things that bring forth health and long life and this kingdom of heaven, this rabbinical term. So you can take these stories and you can internalize them as well. And let's not forget that aspect.
Does the Lost Bible talk about the devil at all, Ken?
Oh, yes. As a matter of fact, there's a lot having to do with Satan. The word Satan, a Hebrew word, Satan, simply means the adversary.
Okay, well, when we come back, top of the hour, let's talk about that. I also want to get your impressions of what hell is. So many people believe hell is here on planet Earth. Is it another dimension? Is it in another universe? I want to find out from you. Dr. Ken Hansen is our guest. He is a scholar, author. He's a lecturer. He is founder of Treasures in Time, his website. He's got a couple are linked up with his name right now on coasttocoastam.com, treasuresintime.org, mansionmaze.com, and we'll be back. He's got a couple great books out, Secrets from the Bible, Dead Sea Scrolls, The Untold Story. We'll be back with him in just a moment on Coast to Coast AM.
Want a time travel? Go back to past shows on Streamlink. Sign up online at coasttocoastam.com.